Hello, welcome to the Producer Joe Show. This one, I'm not going to lie, I think I knocked this one out of the park here, and I'm pretty sure this is going to be a really fun interview. First of all, welcome and thank you for tuning in. And if you haven't subscribed yet on YouTube, please do. There would be many more shows to come. Now, I got to this interview through a podcast that I listened to. The great Ken Levine has a podcast, Hollywood and Levine. Ken is a fantastic scriptwriter. MASH, Cheers, Frasier, the list goes on. And I heard Michael on one of his shows. It was a two-parter, actually. Mine will only be a one-parter. And I just had to get him on. I just had to. And he's gracious enough to join me. His name is Michael Uslan, and he is the executive producer for all of the Batman films and so much more in between. But I don't want to have him holding on any longer, so I will bring him on right there. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Joe. How you doing today?
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me in my little small town studio here.
Happy to do it. We all started in our own little small town enclaves.
I think you can tell here, and I always get the shoulder wrong, whatever, but I am a Batman fan. I always have been. And I mean, you're like a hero to me, and you've done a lot for us people who love the fandom of Batman. And I thank you for everything that you have done.
I appreciate that, Joe. You know, I started out as a fan. I was the consummate fanboy geek, and I wear that as proudly as my red badge of courage as I possibly can. But I am an authentic fanboy. I was there in the earliest days of the organization of comic book fandom in the early 60s. I was at the first comic book convention ever held on the planet Earth. I used to go on the DC Comics afternoon tours when I was off of school. By the time I graduated high school, I had over 30,000 comic books dating back to 1936, to the point where my dad, we moved into a house, he never got his car in the garage. The garage was filled with comic books, but that defines me. That is who I am, Joe.
That is a great dad. I love my garage. That's quite a sacrifice right there.
Yeah, my parents were tremendously self-sacrificing parents.
I love that.
They really were. My older brother, Paul, was a superstar at every single sport he ever did. And I was their younger geeky son who could barely swing a bat. And I retreated into a world of comic books and superheroes. And just as much as my parents sacrificed, but took pride in what my brother was doing and went to his games, my parents sacrificed and took pride in what I was doing, and took me to that first comic book convention and drove me to DC Comics for the tour. And we found out that a lot of the creators of comic books and superheroes from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s lived in New Jersey, where I grew up. And my dad worked 6 days a week as a mason contractor. But often he would take his Sundays and drive me all over New Jersey, sometimes to Long Island or Manhattan, so I could spend time interviewing all the greatest creators of our superheroes. That's the kind of parents that we had. We were very fortunate.
That's fantastic. I had the same type of parents, so I know exactly what you're talking about. And it certainly was a good base for you to do the things that you did and have all that support. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was fun. It was great.
I'm going to try to keep everything in here pretty good in a timeline. I know that I'm going to jump out of it a little bit here, but you have the distinction of being the only person to become an instructor at the only accredited college.
I'll make it simple for you. I was the first ever professor of an accredited course taught in college on comic books. It had never been done before.
Thank you. Yeah. You know it better than I do.
Funny what living it can do.
I appreciate that. So I think it's interesting your career is, and we'll get to the all the Batman stuff in a second here. But when you look at your IMDb page, your credits, it's not just Batman. I mean, you got everything in here. And this is just a snippet of IMDb. This is, you got Justice League in there. You even have, it may have cut off, but Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? I mean, you're a very, very well-rounded person. That takes a special brain, I think.
Well, that was very, very special project for me. My son came home from, I don't know, third grade, fourth grade, and I couldn't believe, working on his homework, how great he was doing with geography and reading maps. And it all came down from this computer game, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? So I went into a school and I talked to his teacher. She goes, "Oh, Mr. Uslan, I didn't create that. That's a very popular new computer game." So the next day, I tracked down the rights, Broderbund, San Francisco. The next day after that, I was on a plane to San Francisco, got the rights. And then it took me, Joe, 2.5 years before I was able to finally sell it to television. And ultimately, it won me the Emmy Award for Best Kid Series.
That's excellent, man. Broderbund, that brings me back a few years. So Batman began in 1939, and that was Bob Kane, of course. But I know that there's a backstory
Correction. Bob Kane and Bill Finger.
That's where I was going with that, because I was actually going to say Bill Finger, because I know that he had a huge hand in it, but he was a bit more. You mentioned this on Ken Levine's show, and I learned so much, is that that Bill was a huge influence on that.
That's maybe an understatement. If you take a look at the documentary, Bill and Me, and Mark Tyler Nobleman's incredible book, he was the guy at the forefront of doing all the research on this, along with Athena Finger, Bill's granddaughter. But I have to tell you, I am certainly one of the last people still standing who met Bill Finger. I met Bill twice and talked to him. And when I was 13, 14 years old, Bill told me how Batman was created. And if I could take a moment and just tell you and your listeners what he told me, he said, Bob had originally come up with this concept. Bob was a teenager at the time. DC Comics editor back then told him that this new Superman thing was really hot, and they were looking for people that worked for DC to come up with more superheroes. So Bob initially created a guy named Birdman, and then he changed the name to Batman and had a picture of a guy in a little red suit with a plain little Halloween mask and real bat wings coming out of his back. And then he went to Bill Finger, who was the writer, and talked to Bill about it and said, "Would you partner with me on this?" And he said, "Well, yeah, but who is this guy?" He goes, "I don't know." He goes, "Well, what's his story?" He goes, "I don't know." So Bill said, "All right." He said, "First of all, they already have Superman. He's got superpowers. So the second superhero should be normal. Let's go the opposite direction. Get rid of the bat wings and just give him a cape that looks like bat wings. And if he's a bat, he's nocturnal. Don't color him red, color him black and dark blue and dark gray. Bats have these cool looking ears and it'll be more mysterious. Give him a cowl and put long ears on it. And do what they do with the Phantom in the comic strips. White out the eyes, always makes him look more mysterious." He said, and then what else? Give him a belt. Because as a writer, we could do a lot of things. He could put things in his belt. And what about gloves, gauntlets with little bat wings coming off of them? Bill later conceived of the Batmobile. It was Bill who created, after a few stories, said, "You know what? I'd have more latitude as a writer if we had a pretend city, not just New York." And one day he couldn't come up with a name, so he opened up a New York phone book. And he just stabbed at something, and it turned out it was Gotham Jewelers in Yonkers, New York, and thus was born Gotham City. And then by Detective number 33, which was 6 issues after Batman was created, everybody thought, well, we better give a backstory, an origin story for this guy. And it was Bill who had already named him Bruce Wayne. It was Bill who came up with the story of Batman's origin. So my question to you and all of the Batman fans out there, when you see Batman created by Bob Kane with Bill Finger, who do you feel was the most predominant creative element to that creation.
Gonna have to go with Bill.
Everyone can draw their own conclusions.
Sure. I mean, that's where I go. Yeah. And do I remember the story correctly? You ended up taking him to a movie premiere?
No, that was not Bill. It was Jerry Robinson. So let's talk about Jerry for a moment. One of my dear friends and mentors passed away when he was about 90. And Jerry was Bob Kane's first ghost artist. And he brought him in, and it was Jerry who co-created the Joker, based first on a playing card that he had, and then co-created him with Bill Finger. Jerry also co-created Robin, Alfred, and so many of the villains, Penguin, Two-Face, the list goes on and on, Scarecrow. And he also never got the credit that he deserved. And it wasn't until our movie, The Dark Knight, that Jerry got a very prominent credit on screen.
Yes, that's
so right. We went to the New York premiere of Dark Knight, and Jerry and his wife went in the limo with me and my family. And as we got there and we got out, there was a zillion people. Half of them were dressed up as Batman or Joker or one of the characters. Paparazzi lined up with television cameras as long as you could see. And as we got out of the car, Jerry said to me, "I'll walk around the back and I'll meet you inside." And I put my arm around him and I said, "No, sir, you're coming down the red carpet with me." So we get to the edge of the red carpet, and thank goodness my son David was right behind us because he took pictures to document this. And I just yelled, like at the top of my lungs, "Ladies and gentlemen of the press, this is Jerry Robinson. He is the co-creator of the Joker." And with that, the cameras began to swing around. Jerry started to walk down with me, and it took him half an hour to get through the red carpet. We get inside, and I took him and Bill Finger's granddaughter, Athena, and I introduced them to Chris Nolan and Aaron Eckhart and to Michael Caine. Danny DeVito was there, Christian Bale. I'm trying to remember everybody who was there at the moment. And I said, "This is the man who co-created your character. And this is the lady whose grandfather co-created Batman and your character." And each one of them gave them a physical bear hug and thanked them for what they had done. And as Jerry gets done being hugged by everyone, he turns around to me with tears running down his eyes and said, "Michael, this is the greatest night of my life."
Wow.
And Joe, wow. You know, nothing. There's nothing better than that. There's just nothing better.
What a great move on your part. I mean, to be able to see that and make that happen. That's just fantastic, man. I'm glad you did that. Thank you.
Well, you know, part of my mission has been since the earliest days, not only to attempt to bring respectability to these superheroes, and in some cases, it has been to return the dignity, restore the dignity as well as the darkness to some of these heroes. Mm-hmm. But it's also to bring credit and acclaim and a spotlight to the creators, because these people were part of a generation that were denigrated by society. Society looked down their nose at comic books back in the 50s and 60s, and they had no respect for the creators, and many of them were driven out of the business. And to see their work now being mounted in museums and in galleries and in universities, and to see them get the kind of respect and attention that means more than anything.
That's awesome. That is so great. So you said you're a self-professed comic book enthusiast. Now, that led to the 1966 TV series with Adam West. And I know you were greatly excited to see that. And then once you saw that, you had a take on it. Can you share your take of the 1966 TV series with Adam West?
Yeah, but it's real important we set it in the context of its time. So that was January 66 that came out. I was 14 and a half years old. I was also deeply, deeply a comic book fan and historian already. I was deep into the golden age of comics and the creation of superheroes. And I knew and I had read all the original Batman stories. And I knew the vision that Bill and Bob had for the character. So I was waiting months for this show to come on the air. And back then, we didn't have much of anything on the air from the world of comic book superheroes. We had, when I was growing up, The Adventures of Superman with George Reeves. And for about one season, we had Sheena, Queen of the Jungle. That was it. Mm-hmm. So for Batman to be coming on, this was major, major, major. And the show starts. I'm in our basement den watching this with two of my friends. And it's in color. Wow. The opening animation kind of looked like Jerry Robinson, Bob Kane artwork. Somebody spent a lot of money on the sets. The car looked really, really cool. But about 20 minutes into the first episode, I realized, oh my God, this is a comedy. They are playing Batman as a joke. The whole world is laughing at Batman, and that just killed me.
Sure.
So that night after the show, with my two friends present, I made a vow. So I made a vow like young Bruce Wayne once made a vow. But he made his vow over the bloody dead bodies of his parents in the street. My parents were safe upstairs in the kitchen. But I made a vow that somehow, someday, I would show the world the true Batman. I would show them the way he was envisioned in 1939 by Bob and Bill as a dark knight, creature of the night from the shadows, stalking these deadly, deranged villains. And I quickly realized part of that goal would be to erase from the world culture these new words, pow, zap, and wham, that were popping out all over. And that was the start of it, Joe. That was the start of what would become a long, long, long quest that would turn into a human endurance contest and ultimately would turn into not just a job, not just a project, not just even a career, but my life's work.
Now, because of those moves that you made, you've earned the crown of Batman's Batman. You are the protector of Batman. And am I wrong on that? I have that right, right?
I have tried to be, but you have to understand something about the way Hollywood works. It's the money that talks, ultimately. Mm-hmm. So there were two or three or so Batman-related projects that I was not cool with at all. And in fact, I tried to stop, even though it was against my own economic interest, because I thought they were going too far afield of what should be done. So you do the best you can, whether that is convincing, cajoling, crying, carrying on, whatever tools you have to do that. And I just did the best I could to protect him. And if things went off the rails, to try to get it back on track. And right. That was very, very important to me. And I think the specific story you're relating to goes back to 1979. My partner, Ben Melnicker, and I bought the rights to Batman from DC Comics on October 3rd, 1979. I was still a kid in my 20s. I had raised money privately and bought the rights to Batman, which today people would go, what? That's impossible. How can a kid in his 20s buy the rights to Batman?
Ben was a very accomplished filmmaker already, right?
Ben was not a filmmaker per se, but he was a legend in the business. Ben had run MGM in its Tiffany days. He was the sole executive vice president and all divisions reported to him. Ben put together the deals for Ben-Hur, Dr. Zhivago, 2001, A Space Odyssey, Gigi and their musicals, chairman of the film selection committee, on the parent board of Lowe's. And he was my dad's agent. He was a real legend in the business. So we had been turned down by every studio in Hollywood when I went out to pitch a dark and serious version of Batman. They told me I was out of my mind. They said, you can't do dark superheroes. You can't do serious comic book movies. You can't make a movie out of an old TV series. So we were turned down cold by everybody. And then it came down, we were down to our last studio to pitch to. And I'm in there pitching with Ben. And it's with one of his old pals from like the 40s or 50s. They've known each other for 25 years. And I get done pouring my heart out to pitch this dark and serious Batman take. And the guy looks at me and he goes, the only Batman that audiences will remember and love is the pow zap wham guy with the pop belly. If you're interested in a Batman movie, I'll consider that. And I looked at him and I said, no. And with that, he leaned in front of me and said, son, better to have a movie made than no movie at all. And I looked at him and I went, no. And that was the end of the meeting. He told me that he tried to explain it to me. He said, Michael, Batman will never be successful as a movie because our movie, Annie, hasn't done well. I said, are you talking about that redheaded little girl who's on Broadway singing Tomorrow? He goes, yeah. I said, well, what does that have to do with Batman? He said, oh, come on. They're both out of the funny pages. That was my rejection at Columbia. So after that meeting, we're sitting on a park bench on the studio lot, and I am despondent. Last studio, final no. And Ben turns to me in his wisdom and says, you know, Michael, isn't it ironic that our last no came from you? He goes, you know what that makes you? I said, yeah, Ben, an idiot. He says, no, no, no. You have this vision of what is true to Batman and his creators. And you won't let them do anything to take anything away from that. You've just turned down big money and your chance to make your first major motion picture as a producer because you're defending Batman. You're protecting Batman. And that's when he turned to me, Joe, and said, you're Batman's Batman. And that's where the title of the book comes from.
That's a great story. And I second his words. I mean, you are the protector. You are Batman's Batman. That's fantastic.
I tried.
So I've been watching your countdown on Facebook. 13 days now.
Yeah.
13 days now till the anniversary of 1989's Batman with Michael Keaton. Can you tell me, I mean, it was just such a revolutionary picture from the standpoint of marketing. I mean, there had to be a trailer rushed out. The billboards didn't have the name Batman on it. You had Michael Keaton. You had Jack Nicholson. It was star-studded. Can you give me some insight on how all that came to be and how it felt? I
mean, yeah, let's see if I can do this in under 7 hours. So let's start with this, because again, it's important that everybody who wasn't around and functional in 1989 understand this in the context of its time. There were no computers, really. There were no social media. And despite that, the topic of this dark and serious Batman movie was everywhere. I'm not kidding. Internationally, newspapers, radio, television, magazines, there was this buzz. And out of my own brethren, comic book fandom and movie fandom, there arose an outcry before anyone ever saw a frame of the movie that were ready to string us up, I thought. How dare you guys set out and now make a movie that's going to be even more campy and silly than the TV series? You've hired a stand-up comedian from the movie Mr. Mom to play Batman, directed by the director of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. You're going to destroy Batman for generations to come. And I mean, I thought they were going to surround the studio with pitchforks and torches. There were petitions being circulated. The Wall Street Journal did an article condemning us basically to death before anyone ever saw the movie. And it was intense. So the decision was made by what I consider to be the most brilliant marketing department of movie history to rush out a trailer as fast as possible with assembled footage of what had already been shot, just to show the world this is not your father's Batman. And that worked.
And it didn't have a score to it either, did it?
No, but that sent the message loud and clear. Yeah. This was something nobody had ever seen before. Nothing like it. It was almost like a new form of entertainment. And then right after that, Warner's unveiled its marketing campaign, and posters and gigantic billboards went up everywhere from Times Square to the Champs-Élysées in Paris. And it was the first time in movie history the name of the movie was not on the billboards and posters. All it had was the giant gold oval with a black bat, and it just said June 23rd. But somehow everyone in the world knew what was coming. Right. In that magical summer of 1989, y'all should have been there. It was magic. You couldn't walk through Times Square, New York, not 20 steps without seeing someone in a Batman hat, Batman t-shirt. They were breaking into bus stops to steal the posters out of the display units. The trailer, a 2-minute trailer, was being sold on VHS and Betamax for $25 a pop in 1989. People were calling the movie theaters to find out which theaters were showing the Batman trailer. They would show up en masse, buy a ticket to that movie, watch the 2-minute trailer, and leave. Everybody knew something was up, and something was up, because it wasn't just the fact that we were about to break virtually every box office record that was around. It was more the story of the worldwide cultural impact that this movie was going to have, that would, as a result, Hollywood would never be the same again. The comic book industry would never be the same again. And the world culture's perception of comic books, superheroes, and supervillains would never be the same again. And lastly, just to punctuate this, I'll tell you what my dear friend and mentor Stan Lee told me one day at lunch. He said to me, "Michael, you know, there would never have been a Marvel Cinematic Universe if not for your 1989 Batman movie." Hmm. I said, "What do you mean, Stan?" He goes, "That's the movie that was the key to Marvel." And sure enough, I always talk about this, Joe. What was so revolutionary about Batman 89 was the genius of Tim Burton. And it was Tim who came up with this big idea. I always call it the big idea. That if we wanted people around the world who had never read a comic book before to believe in a guy getting dressed up as a bat and going out and fighting a guy who looked like the Joker without getting unintentional laughs from the audience, this movie could not be about Batman. He said, "This movie instead must be about Bruce Wayne." That was the big idea. That was the game changer. And that's what Stan said opened the door to Marvel. He said, "Think about it. Everybody loves the Iron Man pictures. They should really be titled Tony Stark. The Spider-Man movies should really be titled Peter Parker. It all comes from the influence of the vision of Tim Burton."
Yeah, and I'd say Stan Lee is probably a pretty credible source. That's amazing. That's really incredible. The movie itself, to me, I think is beautiful. Anton Furst had a lot to do with that. And I just wanted to give Anton a shout out, because that movie just visually is spectacular.
I was closer to Anton than anyone else on that movie process. And afterwards, he moved to New York. He was working on Penny Marshall's movie Awakening. And we used to have dinner probably a couple times a week in New York. And the man was a genius. You know, I don't use the term lightly. I use it for Tim Burton. I use it for Danny Elfman musically. And I use it for Anton. Because what happened was Sam Hamm's script came in, and it had like one line, one sentence describing Gotham City as if hell has erupted from under the earth. So Anton said to me, he goes, I didn't know what that meant. So he went to Tim and he said, what does it mean? And Tim thought about it and said, I think it means New York City had there never been planning and zoning. And that was it. Anton said, I get it. So he studied conflicting styles of architecture and ultimately comes walking back in with the design plans of Gotham City, the Batmobile, the whole look of the picture. Sheer genius.
Just incredible.
I mean, five square city blocks built on the back lot at Pinewood, which had housed Star Wars and the Bond films. And that first day Ben and I were walking through the back lot, Ben turned to me in his wisdom. And remember, he was my dad's age. And he said, Michael, I honestly thought never in my life would I see sets bigger and more extravagant than we had in Ben-Hur. But this beats it. And it was that amazing. And my family was with me, and stunt driver Andy Smith took my kids through Gotham City in the Batmobile.
Oh, wow.
And my daughter was four, my son was eight. And, you know, it's something that they've remembered vividly forever.
Yeah.
And fairly recently, Warner Brothers called me. They were doing some kind of flash event in Los Angeles, and they asked if I would come out. And I went out there with my two kids, who are now parents, and their two daughters. And there they had, from 1988, they brought over exactly the same Batmobile my kids had ridden in.
Oh, man.
And now my two granddaughters got in. And they were,
goosebumps.
You know, it was just one of those amazing, incredible moments. And you think back over everything, Joe, and, you know, I hate to sidetrack you here with personal notes, but it's funny how the personal stuff lasts longer than the professional stuff. I remember when we were filming inside a soundstage on a constructed rooftop, the most iconic moment of the whole movie of 89, when Michael grabs the guy and holds him up to his face and says, I'm Batman, and then throws him down and then leaps off the edge of the building. And we were all up there, me, my wife, my two kids, during the filming of this scene. And my daughter, Sarah, she looked like Shirley Temple. She had a head full of blonde curls. And she's standing literally right under Michael's right shoulder, right elbow. And I said, Sarah, you got to move back. You got to move back. They're going to be filming. And the AD said, no, it's all right. She's out of frame here. She's okay. And they film it. And, you know, to this day, when I see it on the big screen again, I'm always looking at that bottom right portion at the bottom of Michael's elbow to see if I could see just a sliver of that little blonde hair, you know, coming up. But that was, it was amazing that at that moment in time, frozen in time, was not just my moment, but it was my moment with my family.
Yeah, I can relate that with that. I totally understand that. So you mentioned these names already. Two people in particular really shaped my pop culture fandom, my music, my mood, everything. And that's Tim Burton. Well, I'll stop right there for a second. Well, no, they're both included. And Danny Elfman. I was a huge Oingo Boingo fan growing up. And then where he ended up catapulting to. And then Pee-wee's Big Adventure was in huge, still is. To me, it's huge. And for you guys to land them in partnership to make this, I think was just a coup. I mean,
I remember getting a call from Roger Birnbaum over at the studio saying, you got to look at this movie. He goes, I'm going to set up a screening of The Fine Cut. It was Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And you got to look at what this young director has done. He's a Disney animator. So I went over there and I saw it and I was wowed by it. I said, but this is the greatest, most creative collaboration between direction and art direction I've seen. I said, I want to meet this guy. So they set up a series of three lunches for me with Tim. And I was shocked, really, at the first lunch to find out he was not a comic book guy. He was not a superhero guy. I would have thought, gee, a Disney animator, young guy, No, it wasn't. So my first self-appointed mission was to keep him away from all the silly, goofy, funny Batman stuff. Keep him away from Genie Batman, Robot Batman, Bat Ape, Zebra Batman, and then indoctrinate him properly into the world of Batman with Detective 27 through 38 up to the origin of Robin, Batman number one, introducing Joker and Catwoman, and then jumping into the 70s, return to his dark roots under the auspices of editor Julie Schwartz, largely orchestrated by Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams and Irv Novick, followed by Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers, and to show them that stuff. And by the end of the third lunch, I was absolutely convinced this was the guy who could do it. And the rest is history.
I think you chose wisely. And
it wasn't me choosing. It was the good folks at Warner Brothers who ultimately were the ones who had to say yay.
Now, talk about Batman's staying power. I mean, you had, not counting voice actors so much, but Adam West, Michael Keaton, Kilmer, Clooney, Christian Bale, Ben Affleck, and Robert Pattinson. I mean, there's iterations that I think they all have their own flavor, and I do love them all, and I could never pick my favorite. What is the magic to the staying power of Batman?
Well, first of all, you can't put a list like that out without Kevin Conroy being on it. You just can't. The staying power of Batman, the magic, I think it comes down to probably four elements. The most important is the fact that he's human. He has no superpowers. His greatest superpower, I always say, is his humanity. And when you've got somebody like that, it's exactly the way Christian Bale described himself in Dark Knight Rises, that Batman is not a person as much as he's a symbol, that anybody could be Batman if they're willing to step up to the plate, make a commitment, persevere, do all the things a hero needs to do. And that's a lot of self-sacrifice and walking through hell in the process. And I think that's the magic of it. People can project their own philosophies onto Batman. They can project their own politics onto Batman. He is every man for all of us. And very, very, very few characters have the ability to do that. And that's why he'll last forever. You add to that, he has, I think, the most primal origin in the history of comic books. A kid who watches his parents shot to death in front of him and then sacrificing his childhood and making a vow over their bodies to get all the bad guys who did this, mm-hmm. And then staying true to his mission, that transcends cultures worldwide, not just borders. The third element, which I go back to my friend Stan Lee. Stan said, Michael, it's supervillains who are just as important as superheroes, because ultimately it's the supervillains who define the superheroes. And he was right about that. And no one has a greater rogues gallery of supervillains than Batman. And without question, the greatest supervillain ever created, Joker. We could do a 2-hour show just on Joker and Batman. And I think that's very true. Lastly, it's the magic of the car. I mean, it's the car. And no matter how you contemporize it, change it, rebuild it, it's magic.
Yeah, it's funny. You posted this picture earlier, and I said, I think I was there that day. And yes, I did take that picture that day. It was at Comic-Con San Diego. I was working. They had the tumbler there. They had the original, which my wife's dad actually had one of these. The tumbler, which the sound of the tumbler, it's just things that stick with you as you watch movies 100 times.
And it can really do that stuff. I mean, it was unbelievable. Of course, the thing with the Batmobiles, especially the Tumbler and 89, is they had almost no visibility. So, like you had, Andy Smith was driving the Batmobile blind in the sequence at the chemical factory, where he machine guns the door, and then drives through it, and then drives back out with everything, the fire, the explosions. He was really driving blind, and he had to really, really plan hard for that. And the enormous talent that went into that whole process was amazing. Or stuntman extraordinaire Carl Newman, the guy who in the cape and cowl was jumping in and out of the Batmobile. So many different people contributed to the process of making the illusion work and work so well without, again, having any kind of unintentional laughs from the audience.
I flashed that picture because I thought it was the one I was thinking about. I saw a picture yesterday of who I think you're talking about standing behind Michael Keaton without the cowl on. I go, oh, that must be the stunt double.
Yeah, there were two stunt doubles. There was David and there was Carl. But do you have that picture up where he's waving the American flag? Yeah, the upper left picture, that's Carl.
Huh, look at that. That's a great picture. These cars at Comic-Con, were those prototypes or were those film used?
No, those were real. There are some great shots, which I'll be posting over the next few days, of all the Batmobiles being taken down to San Diego. Uh-huh. For that event. And that was magic. You were there. It was as if the Beatles had arrived. And it was that kind of reception, that kind of mania. It really was unbelievable, the reaction of having them all in one place at one time.
Oh, they couldn't tear me away. They're like, well, we need to go back inside. You know, I'm like, I can't. I just can't. You know, it's, yeah, beautiful cars.
Yeah, they had them all together last year at the NFT show in Los Angeles, downtown. And again, wherever they go, the crowds follow.
Yeah. You made mention of Joker, and I have a note here to make a special shout out for Todd Phillips. What a twist that he put in Joker, and the heart and the emotion, and I absolutely love that movie, Joker.
Todd, yeah, it's going to sound like I'm just throwing this term genius out all over the place. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember, I've been in this business 48 years. And there's now maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 people that I cite as geniuses that I've been privileged and honored to be associated with on projects. And Todd is one of the guys at the top of the list there. What he did in reconceiving an approach to not just to Joker, but to break the mold and break the tropes of comic book movies, comic book based movies, was incredible. And it was an important work of true cinema. I always say that cinema at its best is a mirror that is being held up to society, and they are being forced to look at themselves, warts and all, biases, prejudices. And at that moment in time, when America and the world were so polarized and still are, when everybody was shying away from discussing mental health and its connection to gun violence, when people, especially in this country, but all over, lost their civility and no longer knew how to speak with each other, but only to talk at each other. This was a commentary on that moment in time. And it was strong, it was powerful, and it was magnificently executed from top to bottom. And all I can say is, and I will say nothing more than that, but this October 4th, when Joker Folie à Deux opens with Joaquin Phoenix and Lady Gaga, your brains will explode. That's all I'll say.
I got it on my calendar right over there. We will definitely be seeing that. My wife threw out this question, and I thought it was interesting. I'm kind of jumping around now. I want to wrap this up. You've been so generous with your time. I just have a few things left here.
Yeah, sure.
In the films, we saw Robin in two films. Why is there such a why wasn't he included in more films? Do you know the answer to that?
I know an answer to that. And I go back to Stan. I go back to Stan Lee. Stan hated sidekicks. He said to me, all right, he goes, Michael, this is the reason I didn't bring back Bucky in 1964 when I brought back Captain America. When we came up with a new version of the Human Torch, why there was no Toro. He said, at Marvel, when we were introducing the Marvel Age of Comics, we wanted these comics to appeal to an older audience. We wanted them to feel real. And we wanted to break a lot of the cardboard characters and stereotypes that had permeated comic books and superheroes forever. If we showed a superhero who was hanging out all night long with a 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old kid who should be studying, getting a good night's sleep, eating properly, doing his homework, he goes, it made no sense. No sense. Why would an adult guy be palling around with a kid like that all night long? He goes, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So I think that that's been a lot of the theory. Once you move into live action movies, that how do you do that and pull it off successfully? Well, you know, Joel tried by having a much older Robin, a young adult Robin.
I get you.
Tim was toying with it, but it would have changed the entire history and legend of Batman and Robin for him to do that. And why would he change everything about it? Well, because it wouldn't work in live action the way it came off in the comic books. So I think that has had a lot to do with it. Now, Damian's arrival on the scene gives it a different chance, because you're talking about a son of a superhero and a son who is a bad boy and difficult to control and has all kinds of contemporary issues and relationship issues. So the door is opened now to a new way to attempt it. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that evolves.
That's a pretty clear answer right there. I like that. I appreciate that.
Sure.
My personal question that I had is, I could never wrap my head around this one, because watching everything when I was younger, like Incredible Hulk and Batman, how can two superheroes need to fight each other? Batman versus Superman, I suppose, namely, but there's been others.
It's an old comic book trope. And I know this for fact from both the hierarchy of Marvel Comics and DC Comics over the years. Whenever they had a cover of either a hero fighting a duplicate of himself or herself, the issue sold. Whenever they had a shot of two heroes fighting, the issue sold. So from a marketing standpoint, that's probably in the comic book world where that comes from. And then you are either in the hands of or at the mercy of whoever the filmmaker is and the creative choices that filmmakers make. And they, because the comic books have presented team-ups in across the entire spectrum of what you could see, from Batman and Robin being best of buddies and in the early World's Finest covers, playing basketball together and baseball together and riding bicycles together, to the Frank Miller version of them pounding the crap out of each other. Right. So you got that and everything in between. And then you have to rely on the choices that each individual filmmaker has to make.
Well, can't disagree there. I mean, yeah, that's pretty concise. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do you own any of the props from any of the films?
No, I'm not that kind of guy. I don't really keep that stuff. Even my comic book collection, to date, I've donated 45,000 comic books and memorabilia to Indiana University's Lilly Library, which is its rare book library on campus. And I'm very proud of that. So my collection was not simply broken up and sold off in pieces on eBay, but is accessible to students and researchers and historians, you know, for generations to come.
That's a beautiful thing. I like that. Now, my ADHD took over here for a second. I wanted to mention, I thought it was really great in Batman Returns that Tim had found a way to bring back two people from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, that being Paul Rubens and, oh gosh, her name escapes me, Simone. She played Simone in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but they were the Penguin's parents. And that's kind of like a little bit of trivia that a lot of people don't know. So if anybody's watching right now, when they throw the baby over the bridge, that's Paul Rubens and Simone. I just don't know why I mentioned it. Again, my ADHD is taking over.
Well, I would simply say this regarding Batman Returns. To this day, I am still bedazzled by Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman.
Mm-hmm.
Bedazzled. And I always thought that Danny DeVito would make the perfect Penguin. But I had always thought of him as taking the Burgess Meredith version of Penguin and going with it from there and being Danny DeVito. But Tim had a whole different creative vision for that. And again, it's amazing to see what happens when filmmakers with a vision, you know, come in and execute that vision.
I remember Catwoman coming in just saying meow, you know, it was just so, it was a low level meow, you know, but it was just so powerful. Yeah. But I get you with that one. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and then you go down the road and you look at my next genius, Christopher Nolan, what he envisioned. He had a mission. He had to restore the darkness and dignity to Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And, so he was on the same mission Tim Burton was originally, but he was coming at it 180 degrees differently. He was not going to build Gotham City on a backlot. He wanted to make the world believe, and this, remember, this is now a post 9/11 world. It used to be a black and white world of good versus evil, where the Joker was the clown prince of crime. When Chris came into it, it had become a very gray world of order versus chaos.
Hmm.
And the Joker was once again a homicidal maniac. So how do you convince audiences worldwide that this story could actually be real?
Yeah.
How do you convince them at this time that Bruce Wayne could be real today with post-traumatic stress syndrome, a young man on a lost horizon type of journey of self-discovery, who comes back and elects to put on the armor to go out and fight. And he succeeded in that with his casting of Christian Bale, who I think nailed Bruce Wayne for every generation of Batman fan.
I agree.
And was convincing. It made us believe this could be real. Then he had to do the same with the Joker. Now, how do you convince everyone the Joker could be real? He made him into a modern day terrorist who placed no value on human life.
Mm-hmm.
Order versus chaos. And this was chaos. We watched that movie. We were scared of the Joker. He was terrifying and reminded us of the fragility of human life since 9/11. Then he had to convince us that Gotham City was real. How do you make Gotham City real? Well, he made the brilliant choice of not shooting it in New York, where at any moment in time, if you saw Times Square, Statue of Liberty, Central Park, you go, ah, it's New York, and it breaks your suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. He chose Chicago, where if you take two buildings out of the skyline, few people around the world will recognize it, where it had a darkness to it, Lower Wacker Drive included, and was able to convince everybody that Gotham City was real, could be real. And his final mission was, how do you convince all of the people that the tech and all these gadgets could be real? And in his brilliance, he hired Morgan Freeman to tell you all that it was real. And as I always say, if Morgan Freeman says something's true, by God, it's true.
It's true. Yeah.
And that was an amazing thing. That was that took not just Batman, that took comic book movies to a new higher level. And I always credit Chris as the one who finally, when you walked out of one of his films, you didn't have to say, gee, that was a great comic book movie. You could say that was a great film, period, end of story.
Well, I have one last thing on Batman here, and it's more just a commentary, but when it was announced that Robert Pattinson was going to be the Batman, I admit that I had questions, but when we walked out of that theater and saw that it was all scaled down back to his beginnings, and he was raw, and he couldn't swing without hitting the bridge. It's one of the greatest movies I have ever seen. It was taken from a completely different angle, and I absolutely love the Batman and the colors and the music. Michael Giacchino, I can't pronounce that. Everything is just great. I just wanted to throw that out there.
The Batman. Going back, I went back in my files, and it was late 1990 when I first proposed to Warner Brothers that we do a movie that would showcase Batman as the world's greatest detective, something we had never seen of Batman in media before. I had to wait 32 years for that, as everybody was more interested in toys and games and explosions and everything else. But it was worth the wait. And just like in our other movies, where everybody was criticized for, oh, Michael Keaton's going to be a horrible Batman or Bruce Wayne. Oh, Ben Affleck's going to be terrible Bruce Wayne or Batman.
Heath Ledger.
Robert Pattinson is going to be terrible Batman. I mean, it's the same thing over and over again. And it happens, Joe, when nobody has seen a frame of the movie. And you can't look at the actor. You have to look at the director and what the director's vision is to understand it. That's first and foremost. And then, as I say, it is every fan's not only right, but responsibility to criticize a comic book movie. Mm-hmm. But once you've seen it.
It's fair. That's fair. Know, that's
so, like, let's take Ben Affleck. The decision that was made there by the filmmaker was to show a Bruce Wayne in his mid-40s. He was done with it. He was frustrated. He was burned out and had to be dragged kicking and screaming back into it. And Ben Affleck was well suited to that interpretation of Bruce Wayne at that moment in his life. So the next interpretation, it's going to be Bruce Wayne just starting out, where he's still not sure of himself, still tripping over his own feet, trying to define his own mission. He's still not clear with that yet. One of the great things about the Batman is that, thank God, you know, it wasn't yet another comic book movie that for the fifth time redid the origin story. But every single scene in that movie involving Bruce Wayne or Batman, his origin story was drenched in it. Drenched in it. And that to me was a magnificent accomplishment, to be able to do that emotionally and make it as effective as it was. That was really, really awesome. So I love the fact that here you've got a Batman who has not yet evolved into the Dark Knight. And, you know, it's going to take more movies before you can see the character arc. Just the same way with the Batmobile, same way with the villains. They're, with one or two exceptions, they're all just starting out as well. And they have to ultimately define their personas. So it's a wide open slate, and it's very exciting. And again, you've got someone like Matt Reeves running the show and making all these decisions and having the vision. Wow. You know, what can I say besides wow?
I think one of the best casting choices in that film was Paul Dano. He blew me away.
It was an interpretation of the Riddler that would have Frank Orson turning over in his grave, I think. It was so creative and fit in with the times that we live in, the tone and everything that went along with it. The entire cast of that movie was sensational, one after another. Talking to Colin, he was so concerned that fans would appreciate and understand and embrace his interpretation of the Penguin. That was so important to him. And up and down the line with everybody attached, there was that importance to it. It's great to see.
Yeah, that's great. I love that movie. Last thing I want to do here is promote your book. I did get a copy.
Yeah.
I implore everyone to hop onto Amazon and get a copy of this book, The Boy Who Loved Batman. It is your memoir. And it's just jam-packed with really great stuff. And this is one of my prized possessions right here. And if you do ever come down to San Diego, I'm not really huge on autographs, but I would love it if you were to autograph it.
Yeah, you know, Stan always said, when the moment comes, Michael, get in the plug. That was one of his mantras. Sure. The Boy Who Loved Batman, it's Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. I also narrated the Audible book version, and we did very well with that. So I then wrote a sequel book, which is called Batman's Batman, also available through those sources. And I also narrated that Audible book. And currently, The Boy Who Loved Batman is being turned into a Broadway-bound play by the Niederlander Organization of New York. For those of you in the area of Florida, we will open October 1st in Tampa at the Straz Center for the Performing Arts. And we'll be playing there through November 10th. And I would say if you want a geeky, fun, funny night out, come join us there. I think you would really all enjoy it. The other thing I would say would be you certainly are invited to follow along with me on either Instagram or Facebook, or I'm told they are reposting my Instagrams on X right now. But you know, come along for the ride. I try to make it entertaining, mixing comic book history with behind the scenes stuff from the movies. And, I think it's a lot of fun.
Yes, you are a great follow. I follow you, and I'm going to wrap it up here unless you have anything else.
No, sir. I think we covered a lot this time around. Maybe, if you're interested, we could do this again in October after the next Joker movie opens.
Absolutely. And I hope to see you at Comic-Con. I will get down there. I don't work there anymore, but I'll be down there at some point. Hopefully I can run into you there. But
oh, and by the way, we've just got a few days left. I curated in San Diego at the Comic-Con Museum in Balboa Park. I curated the first ever exhibition on the life and legacy of Stan Lee. And it's only up through this coming weekend. We're ending like a 10-month run over there that's been enormously successful. So if you are in the San Diego area.
Okay, there you are. The very end of that got cut up. If you're in the San Diego area.
Yeah, between now and Sunday, please drop on by and take a look. I think you would love what you see over there.
Yeah, they got a great facility down there. The museum is fantastic. Well, I appreciate your time. Very generous, and absolutely, October. Absolutely, thank you. So I will cut you loose now, and I'm going to do my own little wrap up on my end, and we will talk soon. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It means a lot to me, Michael.
Thank you, Joe. You take care.
All right. Bye now. Well, that was fun. Appreciate you tuning in. You can watch us anytime on YouTube. If you haven't subscribed already, give me a subscribe, would you? And we'll talk to you real soon. This has been a lot of fun. And for my outro here, this is a tease on my next guest, which is next Tuesday. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you soon.